Chapter 8. It is very difficult to keep a big secret in a little place, and Iceland was little. The first thing that got into the air was that there was a secret. The second thing was that a certain small group of men, not more than half a dozen, and all of them close friends of Eric's father, were the ones who shared it. The third thing was that others near to them, who customarily learned a secret by simply waiting for it to be told them, were not learning this one. All that was certain was this. The seven men had met in the woods near Thor's temple. A woman who was gathering berries saw them, but they saw her too and stopped talking until she was out of earshot, although she dawdled as much as she could. The next day, one of them bought a ship from a trader, and they let it be known that in 3 days they would sail. That was far from enough to satisfy curiosity, but there was no coping with the resistance of those who held the secret. When anyone questioned them, they said they were going raiding. Nobody believed that, because one of the seven, when asked suddenly where they were going, had absentmindedly started to say something else, then quickly corrected himself to saying, "raiding in the Orkneys." He was seen to make the sign of Thor's hammer as he walked away, as though to guard against another such near slip. Evidently, an oath had been sworn. Theobrand the priest was least ready of all to believe this story of a raiding trip to the Orkneys. He felt that it might be, and suspicion changed might be to doubtless was, a trick to upset his plans, such as he himself would attempt were he in the place of these Icelanders. He knew two ways to learn a secret: to think it out, and to spy it out. He sent for Tyrker. "Do you still wish to help Olaf spread the faith?" he asked, choosing to forget the precise words the thrall had said. Tyrker did not correct him. He simply said, "Yes." "Then here is what you are to do. First, you must go along on that ship. Can you find a way to do that?" "Yes." "At each port you touch, you are to send me an account of all that has happened. I will give you money to pay messengers. Can you do that too?" "Yes." Theobrand indicated that he had nothing further to say, but Tyrker did not leave. "Is there something you don't understand?" the priest asked. "Yes," said Tyrker. "Why am I to do this?" "For the greatest of all rewards." "In this world or the next?" "In both. You shall be free here and happy hereafter." "Then I will do it," said Tyrker, and left. Having arranged for the secret to be spied out, the priest turned to his second method, thinking it out. His mind did not function like the mind of Eric's father. He hated the cursed practice of meandering through old slow beliefs, of communing with nature and idols in order to bring one's own thoughts laboriously to the surface. Hated it the more because it had once been his own way. "Chase away the trolls who make the shadows. Let God's sunlight in." "Here are certain facts," thought Theobrand, "to be examined with the eyes and ears that heaven gave me, and the nose too, to track down the heathen stench that seems to be in them. What are these facts? I will tell them off with my beads, calmly, knowing that the truth will prevail. 1 for the father, 2 for the son, 3 for the paraclete, 4 for the gospels. Now there will be virtue in my reasoning." But virtue or not, and truth or not, he counted his beads in vain. sifting fact by fact over and over, so many times that they ceased to have any meaning whatever. The day before the ship was to sail, he still had only the suspicion he started with. There had been time and ease enough for him to think it through. The traditional 3-day visit was well over, but his hostess had pressed him to stay, with something more in her face than kindness to a guest. The remembrance of the look she had bestowed on him suddenly sent another idea racing through his blood. How desirable she was, and his long continence. He dismissed this hurriedly, perceiving once again how Satan ever lurked in unexpected corners, and returned to his problem. Most suspect was the extreme hospitality of Helga's husband, who had lately been adding his persuasion to hers, begging him to stay and make the house his own, even after the ship would sail. "He hates me," thought the priest, who knew other men's hatred as one knows an old friend turned enemy. "This is not hospitality, but disdain. He feeds me while he laughs at me in his heart. Something makes him confident." There was the first fact, to mark yet once again with the first blessed bead. Now to the next, trying to see it afresh as if he never had before. The Icelanders would sail in the morning. No waiting for the thing, at which their Thor must fight for his life. They had so much to say, those singers about Ingolf and the idol that led him ashore, yet they could leave without saying it to all Iceland, at a moment when their gods needed so badly to be sung about. That, too, was marked again by the second bead, but it only made the same sound as always when it clicked against the first. No matter, have faith. Light will come. To the next point. They were not going to the Orkneys. Theobrand had seen the ship loading up with water and food. They had enough salted meat, herring, and dried fruit to eat their way to the Orkneys and back 6 times. Didn't they mean to live off the land they sacked? What kind of woman's raiding was this? And they had driven live cattle aboard and piled in fodder for them. "Why?" he had asked one of the men, and received the obvious idiot's answer. "For milk." Did they expect to be calmed in the middle of the ocean, and to live a year there waiting for a breeze? There were seats for 20 rowers. "Row, you fools," he almost shouted at their bland, annoying faces, though he was alone in the house and they were all at the harbor. Ah, well. That was the third bead. Click. And four. For the preposterous mad item, the cargo. What was a cargo doing on a raiding ship? Perhaps they were really only going to trade with the Orkney Islanders, not harry them, and were ashamed to show they had so little courage. Even so, why such a cargo as this? Plows, chairs, beds? Things to put in houses and keep farms growing. The Orkneys had no need of these. They made them as well as Icelanders did. He was losing his temper and was about to fling his beads on the floor when a fifth fact ran into the room in the person of little Eric and shouted jubilantly, "I'm going with my father on the raiding trip tomorrow." Well, it was possible, Theobrand reasoned, when he had digested the new surprise. A boy is taken on his first sea journey sometime or other. But not yet. Not quite so young as this. He sat Eric on his knee, trying to seem jovial, but frightening him with his ferreting look. He had to let him play with the rosary and break the string before his young confidence was restored. Then Theobrand, kneeling to gather the beads from the floor and with his avid face thus averted, asked in a casual tone, "Where is the ship going?" "To the Orkneys," answered Eric, both meaning it and liking the sound. "But aren't you afraid to go raiding?" asked Theobran, and somehow remembered a verse that was sung to him in his own childhood in a woman's voice. "Someday your sword will win renown." "Not yet." "Someday another sword will strike it down." "Not yet." "Someday you will be born to Odin's hall." "But oh, not yet. You are so very small." Oh no, Eric wasn't afraid. "Stand there against the wall," he commanded. "Now look." He made the priest pretend to be an Orkney Islander and ran him through with a fancy sword. Then, satisfied that his victim was impaled, he ran out of the house, shouting to any and all that he was going raiding with his father. Eric's mother came into the room. She was the sixth fact connected with the secret that was trying to be kept, though no one knew it, except perhaps Odin and Thor and Frey and Freya and the other divinities of Valhalla, who would once let her pretend to be one of them. Had she made the most of that chance years ago, Theobrand would not now be here, in their house, seeking an augury in his beads. She came in diffidently, asked whether he was comfortable, and hoped that her little boy had not disturbed his meditations. She seemed wholly taken up with household affairs, of which her guest's tranquility was part, and of which her husband's departure on the morrow only made her more conscious. This was indicated at once, not only from the quick, practiced look she cast about a room, but from her housewifely attire, with its apron and the big bunch of keys dangling from her hip. The only detail that belied this impression was the way she wore her hair. It hung down over her back and shoulders, and the ends were tucked into her belt in the fashion of unmarried girls. That suggested that she was younger than one would suppose, but was bravely performing mature duties thrust upon her by life. She blew a speck of dust from the lectern that held Theobrand's book, and gave him a little unobtrusive smile, which told him to go on with whatever he was doing. She was tiptoeing out when it occurred to him that God might have sent her, to help him learn the truth about the raiding trip to the Orkneys. He remembered her rapt look when he was speaking at the feast. "Don't go," he said. "I don't want to interrupt," she began. "A welcome interruption," he assured her, and removed a roll of parchment from a chair to make a place for her. After a moment's fluttering doubt that such an honor could really be hers, she sat timidly on the edge of the chair, as if poised for quick departure when the time should come for him to return to his great thoughts and herself to her little tasks. She waited in modest silence to let him choose the subject of discourse. "What did you think," he asked her at length, "of what was said at the feast the other evening?" "I do not remember what the others said," she replied. "Your words have driven theirs away." "They were not my words," he gently reproved her. "God placed them in my mouth." "I see that, now that you have pointed it out to me," she said, and contritely echoed him, "God placed the words in your mouth." "You speak of God. Have you lost faith, then, in your own gods?" "My life is very unhappy." Her eyes abruptly filled with tears. "It is the old gods who have made it so." She had an impulse to tell him of her sorrows and disappointments, but remembered he was a stranger. He eased the way for her to do so. "If it will make you feel at peace to unburden your soul," he said, "no one but God and I will be listening, and it will never be retold." She was encouraged by his manner and the cross he drew in the air. 7 years, she said, then stopped, as if it were a complete explanation. Have you been unhappy all that time? I have been lonely. And at my father's house before that, no one ever seemed to love you? To want to speak to me. Only to each other. When I would ask something, they were annoyed having to answer me. But your husband and your son? My husband least of all. At the start, oh yes. But it passed so quickly. And he never let me be with my son. Not really. He took him away for whole days. They would come back laughing together and talking together at the table, just as my father and brothers had done. Never to me. No one ever. Until now. Until you. Her feelings suddenly got the better of her. She reached across to him, seized one of his hands and kissed it. You need be alone no longer, my daughter, he said. You may speak with God whenever you wish, and he will answer you. Yes, she exclaimed, with a force and fire he did not know she had. I want to follow your God. Tell me how I can serve him. As if a new and arresting thought had suddenly forced its way upon him, Theobrand stepped back and studied her intently, remaining thus a long time until she grew uneasy and asked what made him stare. Your face. Oh, she said bitterly, my face is not what it was. Neglect and scorn have changed me. You will think me vain, but I once was praised for my beauty. I was called by the names of a goddess, she added proudly. A goddess? Cried Theobrand indignantly. Your face is that of a saint. He pressed on with so much earnestness that he began to mean it a little. I never until now saw a saint's face, he said, with a trace of sadness because of the long deprivation. But I have long known what it would be like. My bishop told me of such a face. He saw it in the wall of a church in Byzantium. It was made of 1,000 little squares of marble, variously colored, but the glory of the heavenly face held it all together as one. People before it stood, and throughout the day, bound by its divine spell, no one who saw it could ever forget its double promise. Of love for those who need love? Helga's heart glowed with kinship for the distant, beautiful mosaic. Or help, he added, for those who are sunk in evil. A saint fulfills both these holy duties, he explained, softening his voice to ease her double saintly burden. Both are ways to serve God, and the opportunities are ever present. There is one now, nearby, who has an evil secret in his heart, placed there by Satan, who hopes thus to thwart the God you and I serve. It has been granted you to learn this secret, my daughter, so that his soul may be saved in our God, not thwarted. I will do whatever you wish, said Helga. Deeming it safe by now, he told her he meant her husband. Placing his hand gently upon her head, as if to steady her for her task, he suggested to her how the secret might be learned on this, her husband's last night at home. It was another of the means justified by the great good end that otherwise were dubious. Later, when he was alone, he wondered whether she really could regain her husband's trust, after relinquishing it for 7 years. He felt just the least bit sorry for her, in case she should fail and be humiliated. Instantly, he banished such compassion, lest it give birth to fleshy appetite, and resisted the impulse to call her back. To purge himself of any possible impurity, he prayed in this fashion. O Lord, you know all things. You see into my heart and search the darkest corners. even if I wished to deceive you, I could not. You know I do not desire this woman or want anything soever from her for myself. You know that all I do, Lord, is for you. To serve you, I will endure any trial, suffer any shame. Therefore, forgive me, Lord, for the deception I have practiced upon her. Nor let it count against me on the last great day. Amen. He rose from his knees, refreshed, cleansed, and secure. Helga had no such recourse as his, not having yet learned the tranquilizing power of prayer. Her only religious acts had been sacrificing before idols, which among Icelanders usually led to deeds, often of a violent kind. Now she was between two faiths, had neither, and felt spiritually aimless. She seized the one thing she could be sure of and clung to it. Out of all the complicated things Theobrand had said to her, she gleaned there was a particular task he wanted done. She would try to do it, to please him.